We're here for argument in case number 23-13583, Corey Sherrod Smith versus the Commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections. We have Mr. Crystal here for Mr. Smith and Mr. Malden for the Commissioner. Mr. Crystal, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. I want to first thank you for the opportunity to discuss this case this morning. My name is Jerry Crystal, as you know, and I represent Corey Sherrod Smith. May it please the court, this case involves a very young man who is 87 days past his 18th birthday when he committed a horrific offense by murdering the young woman he claimed he loved, that he wanted to marry, that had a child with him, and that had broken up with him that very same day. Guilt was never an issue in this case. Within 24 hours, Corey Smith voluntarily went to the police, voluntarily confessed, and this was at a time when the police did not even know that a crime had been committed. They were simply investigating where Kimberly Brooks, the victim in this case, was. Mr. Smith's two co-defendants were offered plea deals that they accepted, which included testifying against Mr. Smith. Two friends who Mr. Smith had confessed to before he confessed to the police were called to testify, and there was corroborating evidence of his confession and the testimony of the co-defendants. So guilt was never an issue here. At trial, the defense didn't put on any witnesses. They had a 5-minute closing argument, and not surprisingly, the jury returned a guilty verdict of capital murder in 30 minutes. The horrific nature of this offense, as I'm sure my good friend across the aisle will note when it's his turn to speak, was never disputed either. The primary, if not the exclusive, focus of counsel in this case with these facts had to have been on mitigation, had to have been on doing a full, complete, reasonable investigation in what would have led someone who was just past their 18th birthday to commit this offense. Counsel hired no mental health professional, not a psychologist.
Can I ask you a question, though? Yes, I know it doesn't necessarily go to the issue that we granted a COA on, but I have just a question about the record. There was testimony during some of the post-conviction proceeding by one of Mr. Smith's counsel that he feared the state putting on somehow, some way, evidence of a relatively similar event or crime committed by or allegedly committed by Mr. Smith. But I didn't see much, and I haven't dug into the entire record, but I didn't see much about where that matter ended up or what happened or why it sort of went away and why the lawyer thought in retrospect he had made a mistake in foregoing the mental health testimony, et cetera. If you could help me with that.
Excellent question, and I realize this goes to the deficient performance, and I'm certainly prepared to address that, Your Honor. The testimony was he had heard, and he didn't recall whether it was from an assistant attorney general or another attorney, that Mr. Smith had what he thought was a similar case. He did no investigation. Well, there's no evidence on the record he did anything other than have that conversation where he was told there was a similar case in Elmore County, and as far as we know, did nothing about it, didn't look into the facts, didn't investigate it, didn't ask his client about it. There is in the pre-sentence report an indication that when Corey Smith was 17 and a half, that there was an arrest in Elmore County in May of 1994 for a kidnapping and a rape. We know nothing than that, other than that, in the record in this case, what the lawyer said and that snippet which was in the pre-sentence report.
There is indication, though, is there not, of some sort of juvenile adjudication in Elmore County?
Not relating to that, as far as I know, on this record. It was simply an arrest at the time. There had been no adjudication of the offense we're talking about now.
Currently, is there some indication in somewhere in the habeas record of an some juvenile adjudication in Elmore County?
There is none in the record, and I am unaware of any. Counsel said that he did this out of fear. And he said, on the record, it was not a strategic decision, and it was not a decision made in any way based on any sort of investigation into what was available in terms of mitigation. I think to answer the ultimate question is, both counsel that represented Mr. Smith at the time both said, had they done the mental health investigation that we did post-conviction, and had they known the facts that we elicited from the experts and from the lay witnesses post-conviction, they would have put that evidence in sentencing and mitigation and dealt with whatever fallout there may have been relating to that other offense.
Right. So, no, I remember that part of the record and their testimony. I just wanted to have some sort of further idea about that other matter. Well, I didn't want to derail you. You're here to argue about prejudice.
Yes.
Can I ask about prejudice? Is it your position, either in brief or here, that the failure to investigate and present mitigating evidence related to mental health problems, which is the issue that we're here for, is per se ineffective, no matter how much aggravating circumstances there are?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Please continue.
Our position is the Alabama Court of Appeals unreasonably applied Strickland in determining in this particular case on these facts that Mr. Smith was not prejudiced by his counsel's failures to investigate and present the mental health evidence that existed. We're not arguing here for a per se rule. I don't think in this type of litigation there are many, if any, per se rules. We're simply saying on these facts, given the clearly established Supreme Court precedent and this court's precedent applying those cases,
let's talk about that. Here, would you agree or disagree that the mental health problem evidence, and again, I'm being very specific in how I'm asking this question, the mental health problem evidence was disputed?
Portions of it. Certainly not the most significant ones, and I'm happy to go over. I'm prepared to go over in excruciating detail what was and what wasn't.
So my question to you is that evidence disputed?
Some of the evidence was disputed. For example, Dr. King disputed the diagnosis of PTSD. That is virtually irrelevant because as counsel for Mr. Smith during the post-conviction testimony at the hearing, when I asked him, would you have presented evidence of PTSD, he said, not because it has the label PTSD, but because of the underlying abuse that Corey Smith suffered at the hands of his mother that led Dr. Mayer to give the PTSD.
So if I can go over a list, and I want to go over to see your position with regard to this list. So
yes,
here's the list that I have, having read all of the underlying testimony here. So Dr. King at docket entry 15-46 at pages 183 and 184 of the transcript said that Dr. Golden did not properly administer the intellectual disability and brain function test and had serious questions about the data that it was administered. True or not true?
It's true that he said that. May I explain what he was talking about?
Well, let's go to, okay. I want to go through this list.
It's certainly true that he said that.
Okay.
So
let me ask the next one. So the scores he concluded were not reasonable to rely on. That was at page 185 of the same docket entry. Is that true or not true?
I'm assuming what you're reading is in the record. I can explain what that meant, because I really do think this is being taken out of context as to what was being testified to.
We'll go through that, but okay. I want to ask about the difference, because the dispute seems to be a very relevant point here, because you've indicated that it's not a lot, and I just want to go through all this. Okay. So Dr. King found that that Mr. Smith was in normal levels for executive functioning at page 195 of that same docket entry. True or not true?
I don't remember if he said that. It's clearly not true, even based on his own testing and the results of his own testing. So he may have made some conclusory remark at one point in the record, but when he was giving testimony, for example, the brain impairment index is a collection of 7 tests. Dr. King's results were virtually identical to Dr. Golden's results that showed moderate impairment.
He disagreed. Is it true that Dr. King disagreed with the intellectual ability that had been rated by the other experts, Dr. Golden in particular?
I'm not sure what you mean by intellectual.
Dr. Golden had said that he was at a borderline level and bleeded into the intellectually disability level. Dr. King disagreed with that, did he not?
No, I think...
That's at page 200 of the transcript.
I think everyone was saying that based on his IQ, we're talking IQ now?
I'm talking about intellectual ability.
Okay. So if it's his IQ, there were times, for example, there was a 1991 assessment where Corey Smith scored a 72, which is in the intellectually disabled range, although none of the experts were saying he was intellectually disabled, because other tests put him in the low to mid 80s.
Dr. King also disagreed with the diagnosis of frontal or temporal lobe damage, did he not? That's at page 204 of that same docket entry.
He may have, but if you look at the test that he agreed was most sensitive for detecting that, which is called a category test, that showed impairment, and that is specifically designed to look at frontal lobe executive functioning, which controls impulse control, which controls behavioral control, which controls decision making. It's like the pilot in Corey Smith's head that is directing and coordinating everything else in his brain, and in his case was wearing blinders. That was certainly impaired.
Dr. King also testified, did he not, that other than learning disability for reading, that Mr. Smith was otherwise normal in intellectual ability?
I think that's correct.
Okay. Did he...
I don't want to be heard to say I think that's correct. I think it's correct that Dr. King said that.
I understand. That's absolutely clear, and that's how I'm asking the questions. Dr. Smith, as you mentioned, testified Dr. King mentioned that Mr. Smith didn't suffer from PTSD. That's at page 21 of docket entry 15-47, right?
Right. And that's because he did not believe that his mother whipping him with an extension cord, whipping him with hangers, and his brother punching him and kicking and beating him up was significant enough for Corey Smith to be in fear of serious bodily harm.
At page 25, did Dr. King testify that as to his drug use, there was nothing that would have affected his ability to appreciate the wrongfulness of his actions or affected his ability to tell the difference between right or wrong at the time of the offense?
He testified to that, Your Honor, but the one thing that's missing is the state never asked him, Dr. King, and there is no evidence that they are disputing the statutory mitigator under 13A551, the second part of subsection 6, which is the inability or the capacity to conform your behavior to the requirements of law. There's testimony from our experts that existed, and Dr. King was never asked about that and did not otherwise render an opinion on that.
Did Dr. King state that, at least as part of an absolute statement, that Mr. Smith, or disagreed that as an absolute statement, that Mr. Smith was emotionally immature for his age at the time of the crime?
He did, and what that goes to, Dr. Mayer testified that Mr. Smith emotionally and psychologically was operating in the 12 to 14-year-old range. Dr. Golden testified, and he's probably one of the premier neuropsychologists in the country. I could go over Dr. Golden's qualifications at length, but he said conservatively Mr. Smith at the time was operating in the 10 to 12 range. When Dr. King was asked in the quote that you just gave, he said, I can't give an app. He said, I'm not sure, is the exact quote, about an absolute number, but I can say because of his low IQ and his impairments, he is immature for an 18-year-old. Now, immature for a person who's 18 years old and 87 days at the time of the offense, I would suggest indicates that he's operating in the level of a juvenile, maybe 17 years old.
Did Dr. King disagree with the assessment that Mr. Smith was under extreme emotional distress at the time of the crime?
He said he was under emotional distress, but he wasn't sure if it was extreme emotional distress.
So
that's the quote.
Did the ACCA, in quoting from the underlying findings here of the state habeas court, the Rule 32 court, as you guys have discussed, adopt the portion that discussed that the underlying Rule 32 court found Dr. Golden and the other expert to be non-creditable or to non-credit that testimony and did, in fact, credit the testimony of Dr. King?
That's right. And I would say the cases in this court, I'm blanking now whether it's Farrell or Cooper, said that it is improper for a court based on credibility to basically reduce to nothing testimony from a defendant's expert about brain impairment, about PTSD, about those kinds of things. So it may have been a credibility issue, but it was never presented for the jury to hear or even consider.
So if I can land this plane a little bit here, I'm having trouble seeing much of a distinction between this case and Pai, where in Pai, the evidence was disputed, not all of it. Mm-hmm. The prosecution expert agreed with some things, but the evidence was disputed, and the court there said that in reaching its conclusion to discount the evidence, the state habeas court could have not credited the testimony of the defense experts and did credit the testimony of the prosecution expert.
That's right.
How can we not find that it's reasonable for the state court to have reached that conclusion under very similar circumstances to the point that it was Dr. King, the same exact expert?
Right. That's right. This is a particularly unique case. I don't know if there's another case where the age of the defendant was as close to the cutoff where Roper would have prohibited the death penalty. If Corey Smith had committed this offense 3 months earlier, the death penalty would have been off the table. In Pai specifically, Pai said with respect to the childhood abuse, because the petitioner in Pai was arguing childhood abuse as a mitigating factor and Pai was 28, the Pai court said childhood abuse would, quote, more likely influence a jury if the defendant was barely an adult,
Mr.
Smith was.
I want to be clear because this is important. The question you were at, the COA question that the parties were asked, is specific to mental health problems.
Yes.
It is not family issues were taken out of this. So the way that the ACCA court, the way that the federal district court separated out is there were two silos of evidence. There was family problem evidence, and there was mental health problem evidence. I see you shaking your head no. I can quote to you directly from both.
No, I understand, but I want to put this nicely, so I want to watch my words. To say that childhood abuse is not a mental health issue doesn't understand what childhood abuse is.
Let's be clear. There are facts underlying,
right,
which you are correct. You're absolutely correct.
Which were never presented to anybody.
I understand.
Nobody ever heard that.
I understand. And then there's the mental health conclusions from those facts. The COA asked about the mental health problem, which are the conclusions of these underlying facts.
Well,
right?
No. The COA was clear that it wanted briefing on the issue of the failure of counsel to investigate and present mental health evidence. Childhood abuse is evidence that speaks to mental health.
Except that counsel, the way this has been litigated, both by you, the state, and in the state habeas courts and in the federal district court, was that there are two kinds of evidence here. There were family problem evidence, childhood abuse, as you're talking about, and then the mental health implications of those. That's really what we're here to talk about today.
Well, Your Honor, I most respectfully disagree there were two silos in terms of whether the evidence about mental health was coming from lay witnesses, which would be the childhood physical abuse, the substance abuse, and then there was the expert testimony about the testing and the evaluation and the mental health testimony from the experts about the effect of the childhood abuse, the substance abuse, the auditory processing deficits that he suffered. This was a kid whose older brother, when he was 7 or 8, taught him to huff gasoline by opening the gas can, sticking his nose in, and inhaling it. And he did that up until the age of 13 or 14, because we know in 1993 there's an assessment that talks about his abuse of inhalants. Now, it is true, the mental health experts then talked about the effects of that, but the jury, putting aside the mental health evidence, had a right to hear what was in this young man's life. What was he thinking when he went and murdered his girlfriend and the mother of their child?
Mr. Crystal, you're running out of time. And
I know that.
No, it's not your problem. It's ours. And we'll give you more time as needed. So let me assume that you're correct, that all of this evidence can't be divided into specific categories of lay family problems, etc., and expert mental health testimony, that they bleed over to some degree. But you've got AEDPA deference to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is not simply whether or not under the old pre-AEDPA standards you've shown Strickland prejudice, but whether or not the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals, and to some degree by definition the Rule 32 Court, acted unreasonably.
Yes.
In finding no prejudice.
Yes.
Tell me why you think you're able to clear that deferential hurdle.
Thank you for the opportunity, Your Honor. The standard, as you know, is whether or not there's a reasonable probability that had this evidence been presented to the jury and to the court, that there would have been a different outcome. Under that standard, I don't think there's any question that if the jury had heard this and the court had heard this, the court said at the sentencing hearing of the courts, September 14th of 95, before he imposed sentence, what happened to Corey? That was a central question that was on the judge's mind. And if this had been presented, this would have been something that would have shown a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And the other lens that you can look at the prejudice question.
Right, but that is just regular. I don't want to minimize what I'm saying.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying.
We deal with all these very technical terms, and sometimes it sounds very cold and abstract. So I get what you're saying. We've all been doing this, unfortunately, for a long period of time. What you just described is, correctly, I think, the Strickland prejudice test. And if you were dealing with de novo review, that's exactly the way someone in your position would be making the argument about why Mr. Smith has shown prejudice here.
Right.
But now you've got the AEDPA layer. So tell me about that AEDPA layer.
Yes.
And why you surpass it.
In DeBruce, which was this court's opinion from 2014, the court was summarizing the Supreme Court precedent on exactly this issue and was looking at the cases that were both AEDPA and pre-AEDPA. And the court said, quote, in applying Strickland in cases where counsel has failed to introduce any of the available mitigating evidence of the defendant's mental impairment and history of abuse that should have been discovered by adequate investigation, the Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected arguments that the defendant is not prejudiced by the complete omission of this type of evidence. This was a complete omission, and I think, importantly, there's a direct nexus between the evidence that was omitted and the commission of this offense. Now, direct nexus is not required, but it certainly existed in this case. Corey Smith's family background and his abuse by his brother and his mother and his seeing his father beat his mother and him seeing his brother choke out his brother's girlfriend, all were something that is directly related to how he processed when he was upset about the breakup. The only answer he knew, because he's 18 years old and modeling behavior after what he learned from his family, was to strike out with violence. And that's what he did. And I think DeBruce is answering the question that even under an AEDPA deference analysis, there is prejudice. The other way where there's...
How do we square that with Pye? And I'll talk about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Thornell in a second. But in Pye, we said there is no per se rule that the failure to present evidence of a defendant's cognitive defects at sentencing is prejudicial for purposes of Strickland ineffective assistance analysis.
Well, I don't think DeBruce was laying down a per se rule, Your Honor. What I do think Bruce was doing is simply summarizing...
But that's how you're arguing it to us, and even if it is a summary of existing law...
If it's a summary of existing law...
Pye is an en banc case from 2 years ago. I mean, that is our statement of law with regard to exactly the issue you're talking about.
And under Pye, we had a 28-year-old, so the abuse that was not presented was something that the court said was attenuated.
There's clearly different facts.
Yes.
No one's arguing that. But it's not enough to say that this wasn't admitted and therefore there has to be a deeper prejudice. That can't be right.
And nor am I saying that, Your Honor. I'm not saying there's a per se rule. The other lens that Strickland and the progeny of Strickland and this court's cases that apply Strickland is whether or not the sentence itself is reliable. Now, we know that a death sentence is unique in both its severity and its finality. And we know there has to be acute reliability in a capital sentencing case. And in this case, AEDPA deference or not, it is unreasonable to hold that this was a reliable sentencing, that we can put this man to death for what he did at that time when counsel failed to present evidence that they had no knowledge of that went directly to what happened, which was the question posed by the court, and why Corey Smith did what he did on that day. If there are no other questions, I see I'm over my time, and I do thank the court.
We'll give you your full time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Dylan Malden for Alabama. Corey Smith's trial counsel did not provide ineffective assistance, and the Alabama State Court certainly did not act unreasonably in rejecting this claim.
Counsel, let's go ahead and assume that trial counsel was deficient, in part because during their testimony they admitted that they would have done things differently. I am focused on the prejudice prong, and particularly whether or not indeed a medical mental health diagnosis is necessary for purposes of still considering the underlying family issues that occurred. So my first question is, number one, to clarify for the record, was there any evidence refuting the fact otherwise that Mr. Smith was severely beaten and otherwise physically abused by his family?
So,
yes or no?
I don't think it's really yes or no answer. So there was nothing refuting it, but if
okay, no. In terms of the drug abuse and alcohol abuse, was there any evidence suggesting that he was not exposed to these types of chemicals at a young age? Again, just yes or no. Did the state present any evidence to say that he was not exposed to alcohol and drugs when he was a child?
Yes. There was a juvenile report about right around the time that Corey Smith was arrested, and at that time he said he was not using drugs or alcohol. Now, there were some other reports from a few years before that were conflicting, but one thing that's really important about this drug and alcohol...
So when did any of the experts that were retained during this case debate that in terms of whether or not indeed he was exposed to drugs and alcohol at a young age?
Well, they did debate it, but Dr. King found that had no influence.
Okay, but Dr. King didn't debate whether or not indeed that happened, correct?
He did not, but
okay.
This court...
So then my question goes back to my original premise, which is a diagnosis of PTSD or a low IQ or any of those kinds of disorders necessary for a jury to still be influenced for purposes of sentencing by the unrefuted facts regarding the abuse he suffered as a child?
Well, I mean, I'm not really sure, but I mean, here, like, that's separated from mental health, that's outside of the COA, and from what it sounds like from Judge Luck, admittedly I hadn't thought about that until now, but I think Judge Luck is correct that this evidence below was used to show similar type of evidence that was used at mitigation, just that Corey Smith grew up in a very harsh environment. And then that's different from the mental health diagnosis. There were kind of two tracks in the court.
Well, that's the point. I think Judge Jordan, actually, while I don't disagree with Judge Luck's recitation of the underlying record, I think Judge Jordan's articulation of the blurry line better fits or describes the situation. So in that instance, is it not, and again, I realize with AEDPA deference, I'm just trying to understand how this evidence could have influenced the jury if it had been presented. So again, do you know of any cases that would say that the jury would not necessarily be influenced in some way by just the family history? Again, that do you need a diagnosis, or is the family history also enough to support mitigation?
I think it could be, but I think it's a separate question, and that's not the use that Corey Smith was trying to use it for. That's
all right. Thank you for that. Now, I know that we're going to, Judge Luck also made reference to the Supreme Court's recent case in Thornell. And in that case, the Supreme Court seemed to rely to some extent, if not heavily, on a need for a causal connection. What is your response to an argument that indeed there was a causal connection here between the violent family history that Mr. Smith experienced and his violent crime, which I will gladly admit was very, very violent?
Well, so causal connection from the mental health diagnosis, I mean, the first point is the Rule 32 court did not credit those findings. It credited Dr. King, who disagreed with all of the major conclusions on that point. And then the second, as far as nexus go, I mean, this court has recognized before that when the facts of the crime don't line up with the diagnosis, that can actually hurt the defendant more than it can help. And so if you look at, you know, the assertion that Corey Smith was impulsive and couldn't control his actions, this was no split-second crime. Corey Smith kidnapped Kimberly Brooks at gunpoint, and when he got in the car with his accomplices.
I understand. Again, there's no debate that this was a horrific crime, and he admitted, which is why we're here at the sentencing and not innocence. But my question, again, goes to the causal connection and trying to understand how this court is supposed to wrestle with that, if indeed it is the new standard to follow. Is it that violence begets violence, and we don't look at the facts of the violence, or does there have to be a more close relationship between the violence experienced on both ends?
Well, so again, for the mental health evidence, I think there has to be some indication, or at least it makes the evidence more persuasive, that the mental health disorder is what caused the violent crime.
There was, putting aside standards of review for a moment, and they're obviously critical in this case, but his evidence at the post-conviction hearing on the mental health evidence side was that there was a connection. Now, I understand the way that the Rule 32 court dealt with it, and to some degree, the Court of Criminal Appeals, but from his perspective, there was certainly an attempt to tie the PTSD diagnosis to what happened, that the episode of, you know, the former girlfriend rejecting him and breaking up and the possibility of losing contact with a child was the triggering event. Now, you can say all you want about that and why it wasn't valid, but he had testimony creating that nexus at the Rule 32 hearing, right?
Yes,
the state obviously disagreed with the diagnosis through its expert, but he had testimony creating that nexus.
Yes, I agree. His experts did try to connect the dots. But what I'm saying is the court can still just look at the facts of the crime and see that they don't line up. And what I was getting to...
But a court can't do that completely. I mean, the job of the court is not, on a prejudice analysis, is not just to completely forsake the impact it would have had on a jury in terms of Strickland prejudice. A court is engaging in post hoc balancing, right? Trying to take into account the aggravating evidence that was presented, the mitigating that was presented, the mitigating that wasn't presented, the aggravating that wasn't presented, and trying to figure out by looking backwards whether or not Strickland prejudice has been shown and then applying AEDPA deference on top of it. But a court just doesn't get to make a decision for itself.
Well, I mean,
on the way it would have viewed the evidence as a 13th juror, right?
No, yeah, yes, I agree. But I think the court can take this into consideration when trying to determine how the jury would have assessed it. And the case I was mentioning is Bryan versus Singletary, 140 F 3rd, 1354. It's a 1998 case from this court. And it was a similar set of circumstances where the expert diagnoses just didn't really make sense with the crime. And so here, like, whether Corey Smith being impulsive caused the commission of this crime, it happened over a pretty long amount of time, and he had multiple chances not to do what he did. He found her alive after his first attempt to kill her.
But the frontal, this evidence was disputed, but the frontal lobe evidence, the testimony about that, would have explained why, if believed, if credited, would have explained why someone like him would have done what he did, right? That he wasn't able to really tell right from wrong under the circumstances, given the pressures that he was under. You're saying there was no testimony to that effect on his behalf at the post-conviction hearing?
So I think the frontal lobe injury was more connected to impulse control.
Right.
And yes, and I think there was that testimony which was disputed, and
I'm giving you all that. But yeah. you seem to be suggesting, and maybe I'm just not hearing you correctly, but you seem to be suggesting that even on his end there was a failure to connect the dots.
No.
I'm not sure that's the case.
No, not on his end. I'm just suggesting that the way that a jury could view this skeptically, and that this court can afford it less weight because it just doesn't really line up. And then even one of Dr. King's own experts, Corey Smith's own experts agreed that he knew that it was wrong to kill Kimberly Brooks, especially in the way that he did, that it just, maybe he wouldn't have understood quite exactly how bad it is. But again, that's contested as well.
Can I ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Yes. Crystal at the beginning with regards to the other matter that mm-hmm. Mr. Smith was supposedly involved in? Does the record tell us anything about that case or the way it ended up, either pre or post conviction and sentencing in this case?
Yes. So the record doesn't really tell us, and it is my understanding that those records are still sealed.
Okay.
To this day. But I think
somebody could have tried to get them and present them under seal again, right? But you're saying the records don't exist in this habeas record?
They don't really go into detail now. There's
okay.
Just, but
here's can I just follow up on that one point? Here's what I understand the record, to the extent it exists, shows. And this is at docket entry 15-52 at page 14 of the CMECF record. And this is discussing the mitigating factor that the defendant had no significant history of prior criminal activity. Here's what the sentencing court says. Quote, defense counsel did not urge this mitigating circumstance at the sentencing stage of the trial, but the court finds, based on the evidence, that the defendant has no significant history of criminal activity. No doubt the fact that the defendant has a juvenile record discouraged defense counsel from taking the risk of actively asserting this mitigating circumstance to a greater degree than it did. There's then a footnote which says that I understand and I know of the record, but I'm not considering the underlying record in this sentencing. And then says, to do so might have opened the door to the state to offer evidence of past wrongdoings. Insofar as this court is concerned, however, the defendant has no significant criminal history. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. I was just meaning we don't really know much about the specifics. But one really important point on this that you kind of hit on, Judge Jordan, is to the extent the record is unclear about something, I believe it's under Dunn versus Reeves, that's in our favor. It's the petitioner's burden to show that his trial counsel acted unreasonably. It's not the state's burden to show the opposite.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to make a normative point. My question was just about what the record showed or didn't show about that. But we have, aside from the language Judge Luck read from the trial court sentencing order, we have nothing else about the specifics of that juvenile disposition in the record?
I think it's mentioned in a pre-sentencing report, which that is cited, I believe, in our brief.
But those are about the allegations?
Yes.
But not about the disposition?
Yes.
Allegations are sometimes proven 100% correct. Sometimes they're proven 70% correct. sometimes 50% correct, and they can all lead to an adjudication of either guilt or delinquency, as in this case.
Yes.
And we don't know that here.
Correct. But one, I'm not sure if it was discharge or a separate one, but in the oral sentencing order, the judge talks about a separate charge that Corey Smith had, and the judge basically said, you know, this man's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. There's no need in wasting our time doing that. I don't believe it was the same charge, but the record's really not clear one way or the other on that.
Okay.
Okay. Getting back to why the ACCA did not unreasonably apply Strickland, this court numerous times has pointed out that significant aggravating evidence can outweigh even strong mitigating evidence. For example, it's noted that in Bayh. And here, the mitigating evidence isn't particularly strong in light of the fact findings, but the aggravating evidence is incredibly weighty. And so the trial court here found that Corey Smith's crime was heinous, atrocious, and cruel. And in Alabama, that is defined as when the killing goes way beyond what is necessary to cause death, whether the victim experienced appreciable suffering, and whether there was psychological torture. And torture is essentially when the victim knows for a long amount of time that they're going to die. And, you know, those were the circumstances here. Like, after she had been shot in the head, Corey Smith picked her up, and they rode around with her for miles, talking about how they needed to kill her and get rid of her body, and then only to drive her back to the same place where Corey Smith shot her, and he suffocated her with a bag over her head as she struggled, and then burned her body. Then, again, as the trial court found in sentencing, there can be no question that these facts are incredibly, incredibly aggravating. And on the mitigation, I want to emphasize again, I believe my friend on the other side said that all the key parts of the mitigation were not disputed, but that just isn't true. Everything that could, kind of getting back to your point earlier, Judge Jordan, that could really like even come close to explaining why Corey Smith committed this crime, all of that was disputed. The brain damage, the emotional distress, and the PTSD.
Do you think the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals made any credibility findings with regard to the experts, or just simply rested, as it said at the end of its opinion, that the mental health testimony from the experts was challenged and disputed?
Well, so, I mean, I think Judge Luck was correct to point out that under Bayh, it is reasonable to read it as having made that credibility determination. But also, I mean, so under, it's a little bit different document, under Loggins, this court still defers to state trial court decisions unless they're displaced on appeal. And the credibility determination wasn't overruled in any way by the ACCA, and it would really make sense to care more about what the Rule 32 court thought about the evidence. That's the court that, you know, sat and listened to these witnesses testify and, you know, had this, you know, long hearing, and it wasn't just reviewing a cold record like the Rule 32.
After Bayh, are we stuck with the justifications and only the justifications for which the state court relied on, or after Bayh, are we to look at any basis or any reason that the underlying state court could have determined that there was no Strickland prejudice here?
So it was the latter. In Bayh, the court said, you know, we're not looking at justifications, we're looking at reasons, and as a reason the court gave, like a reason would be there's no prejudice. And the court would look to the reason, like no prejudice, and it could essentially come up with any reasonable basis.
So I guess my follow-up question is, if there was no explicit reference to finding certain experts more credible than other experts, so imagine that didn't exist either at the state, the Rule 32 court, or in the ACCA, could we look at this record and determine that a state court could have reached a conclusion that some evidence was more or less credible than other evidence?
So I believe so, yes. I'm not completely sure I understood the question.
I'll try my best to be clearer about it. So let's assume for the moment that the state court, so the Rule 32 court, I think you and I agree, said,
yes,
I find this testimony not as credible, and I find this testimony more credible, right?
Yes.
Okay. Imagine that didn't exist
okay.
at the state court, say the Rule 32 court. Imagine it didn't exist at the ACCA. Could we determine that a state court could have reached that conclusion given the conflicting evidence?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's what happened in Bayh with the mental health evidence, exactly.
Like it did.
Yes. So, I mean, there was, again, Dr. King was testifying. And there was a little gap where there wasn't a direct dispute about the mental health diagnoses. And the court said, well, it would be reasonable on these facts for the trial court to have made this credibility determination.
But you can't. Oh, let me see if I can push back against that a little bit. You may be able to do that when there's a complete absence from the state trial post-conviction court or the intermediate court of appeals about anything on credibility. But if both courts expressly disclaim any credibility findings, you're saying we can, and I'm not suggesting you came up with this, but you think we could do credibility ourselves in the sense of saying the courts could have found credibility this way as opposed to that way when they've expressly disclaimed to do that very thing?
So if they have expressly disclaimed, I mean, then I'm not so sure. I mean, in like a different context, for example.
Sure. Think of the state. Think of a hypothetical where the state post-conviction court, the trial court, says, "I will assume that the petitioner's experts are credible, and what they say is credible." Even assuming that, the petitioner loses on prejudice for these reasons. Court of Criminal Appeals says the exact same thing. We will assume, like the trial court, like the post-conviction court, that the petitioner's experts are credible and their testimony was credible. Even with that, he loses on prejudice for these reasons.
So, I mean, I'm not so sure. I mean, again, that's just not this case, of course. We do have credibility determinations. But in that circumstance, if you think about what AEDPA is all about, it's to keep federal courts from acting like, you know, super appellate courts and, you know, grading the papers of the state courts. And it would make sense that if you could look at a record and say, okay, well, they could have made this determination.
But, you know, we're also supposed to be treating state courts as intelligent organs. And if we're just completely ignoring what they're telling us, that seems to be at least a little bit counterproductive too. Well, so you're telling the Alabama court, you really don't know what you're doing. What you should have done was this, and any intelligent court could have done that, and we're going to affirm on that basis, even though you haven't articulated it, even though you rejected it. This is just my personal opinion, so you don't have to take it for anything, and you don't have to respond to it.
On that note, let me jump in. So your opposing counsel makes this argument, I believe, and that is that even putting aside the conflicting evidence, so in other words, let's credit Dr. King always and every time where there's a conflict with Dr. Golden and the other doctor's name I'm forgetting at the moment. Dr. King still agreed to a certain extent that there was some cognitive difficulties, that he was a low to high borderline intellectual intelligence, that he did have some drug problems. He disputed the character of it, but he had some drug problems. And that there was some immaturity, although not to the extent of the other doctors. Is that a fair recitation of Dr. King's opinion?
Well, so for the most part, I want to kind of get back to the maturity point. Dr. King said, you know, I can't really say immature in the absolute sense. It's such a relative term. I wouldn't say that he, you know, went so far as to say, oh, you know, Corey Smith acted like a 10-year-old.
I don't think he agreed with the other doctors, but he acknowledged some immaturity. Agreed?
Yes.
Okay.
And so
there's some things of which, again, crediting Dr. King, that was favorable to the defendant with regard to mental health problems. And so I guess my question is, we'd have to weigh that in the AEDPA prejudice calculus as part of mitigating evidence for Mr. Smith. How does that play into the overall basket? Because I think that question we have to answer, which is, it is enough just to say there was a dispute in evidence here and so a recent court reasonably concluded, because Dr. King himself acknowledged certain things. So how does that play into the reasonableness calculus at the state level and then the AEDPA calculus at our level?
Well, so on at least the emotional immaturity point, I'm not really sure I would say that the state court credited in like any significant sense. It credited Dr. King's borderline or bottom line conclusion, which was that, you know, Corey Smith was overall normal aside from his like borderline IQ, and he might have dyslexia. And Dr. King, of course, he did explain that immaturity was in part due to his intelligence. But as far as how does it affect the analysis that Dr. King was credited, the factors that, you know, where he did agree with Smith's experts just aren't all that mitigating, especially in light of the overwhelming aggravating evidence.
having borderline intelligence, having some level of immaturity, having a drug issue, and acknowledging that there's some cognitive difficulties is not significantly mitigating. I mean, hasn't the Supreme Court said those exact factors are mitigating evidence for which a jury should hear?
Well, so for one, getting just to the drug abuse evidence, this court and the Supreme Court have recognized numerous times that can be more helpful than or more hurtful than helpful. It can actually be aggravating.
It certainly
evidence.
Can be, but yes. it also does explain behavior.
Yes, but and again, under AEDPA, I think it would have been reasonable for the state courts to conclude that it just didn't outweigh the aggravating evidence. So again, I mean, this isn't de novo review. It's just looking, okay, well, in this circumstance, how aggravating or how mitigating is this? And to give it less weight.
Well, that's essentially what the ACCA did, right?
I'm sorry, what was that?
That's essentially what the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals did.
Yes, it thought that the aggravating evidence outweighed the mitigating evidence, even to the extent there was
some. Noting the areas of agreement, and then noting the areas of disagreement with regards to the expert mental health evidence.
Essentially, I think, yes. If I understand your question correctly.
Right. It seems to me the district court got the procedural part of this case exactly right, and we've got to figure out the substantive part. But as the district court explained, there was agreement between the two sides of mental health experts on some things, and there was disagreement on others. And the question is, when you take everything into account and you apply AEDPA deference on top, whether or not the Alabama courts acted unreasonably in finding no prejudice.
Yes, and so, I mean, if you take the Alabama courts to, again, to have credited some of the agreement, well, you also need to give deference to their determination to the evidence, which, again, the Rule 32 court viewed firsthand, that it wasn't enough to outweigh the aggravating evidence. Both of those get deference.
Does Pye help us with that question, the one Judge Jordan just asked about? Because in Pye, let me ask you this then, before I get to that final question. So in Pye, did Dr. King, as here, agree that there were some agreement between the experts regarding some mental health problems that the defendant in that case had?
Yes, there was some agreement.
Like, what was that? Do you remember?
I don't remember exactly what it was. I believe that it was somewhat similar to the evidence here.
I'm reading from page 1050 of Pye. Dr. King agreed that even though Pye didn't meet the threshold for mental retardation, now we call that intellectual disability, He had cognitive deficits in a number of areas that would have affected his ability to function in the community.
Yes, which again is exactly what we have here.
And what did we say regarding that sort of agreement as part of the larger calculus in Pye?
So I believe it might have been that the state court could have discredited the evidence to some extent, but it also could have determined that the aggravating or it could have reasonably not given much weight to that agreement.
Or it found that just given how aggravating the circumstances were in that case, that it didn't outweigh the prejudice, or it didn't outweigh the mitigating evidence, even with the admission of Dr. King to cognitive deficits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which again, I mean, that's exactly the case here. As far as aggravating evidence goes,
what was the aggravating evidence that we looked to in Pye?
There was a man who kidnapped a woman who, as Judge Jordan pointed out in his concurrence, was arguably the mother of his child, gang raped, and then murdered her. And then there was premeditation and essentially
enlisted associates, right?
Yes.
There was a number of, there was a long period of time. In other words, it wasn't a quick thing.
Yes.
It was a long period of time.
Yes, and there was a long period of time here. Associates, you know, mother of the child, and then, you know, she was riding around in the car as they were discussing what they were going to do.
There's one question I have, and I don't want to ask you about the similarities between Pye and this case in terms of aggravation, because that seems to be relevant. But one interesting thing about Pye is, did Pye focus on the aggravating factors that were found below, or did it look at the aggravating circumstances of the overall crime to determine the aggravation?
Well, I think it did a little bit of both, which I think is, you know, the proper analysis. It's not only the amount of aggravators, but how much weight should be attributed to each one, and the underlying facts of the crime go to the weight.
In other words, it's not just like 3-2
yes,
on one
yes.
side.
Yes, it's not just the numbers. And this court has said that numerous times, that it's the weight of the evidence backing up each of the aggravating factors. And here the weight is, I mean, Corey Smith, he admitted what he did.
Does Alabama, as a matter of state law, allow non-statutory aggravators or not? I don't recall.
They do not. They're just statutory. But I mean, the key one here is heinous, atrocious, and cruel. And one of the most important.
And the other one was committed within the course of a kidnapping.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. And under heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and I got into this earlier, one of the most important things is whether there was psychological torture. And that involves, you know, being with the victim for long. The ACCA goes through this. It's not in the IAC mitigate part, but it's a different enumeration of that opinion. But it talks about how torture is being with the victim for a long amount of time when she knows that she's going to die. And I mean, that's just exactly what happened here. That was true when they were in the car together, and it was true when Corey Smith put a bag over her head and fought and suffocated her as she fought back. And if I could, I would like to touch on deficiency just very shortly.
Should we consider that?
So I think as far as the scope of the COA goes, in this Crawford versus United States, 805 Fed Appendix 758, that was a case where the government raised alternative grounds to affirm on appeal, and this court said, you know, that was fine. And essentially the reasoning is the COA is meant to limit, you know, habeas petitioners. It is a safeguard from them filing abusive claims at court. And I mean, that's why the government doesn't even have to, you know, obtain a COA.
I will say it seems really odd for you to make that point, and whether you can or can't is something in debate in my head. But even assuming we could get into it, I think Judge Abudu mentioned this, but the counsel specifically said this was not strategic. This was not thought out. I mean, as plainly as could be said, he said that this was not a strategic call in any way, right?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the court has been clear numerous times that, you know, you can't, you know, assess the wisdom of a strategy in hindsight. You have to address it at the time it was made. And, you know, we had an experienced trial counsel. He had taken 8 capital defendants to verdict. He had tried about another dozen, or had worked
on
another
dozen. But the evidence, well, the record also shows, as elaborated upon during this hearing, that even counsel recognizes that he should have, in real time, done more. I guess my question is this. I understand the case law to be that just because trial counsel admits that he or she might have been deficient doesn't necessarily equate to a Strickland violation. But if trial counsel admits that they were deficient and the record supports that they were deficient, do we even have to address or make our own individual conclusion that trial counsel was deficient?
Well, I mean, I think in this case, the Rule 32 court did it, you know, affirmed on this basis that is entitled to epidefference under Loggins. So I do think so. And I mean, I see I'm out of time.
You can finish answering the question.
And I think if you look at the record, Corey Smith's experienced trial counsel, he said, you know,
I understand all that, again, especially given you don't have any more time. If trial counsel admits they were deficient, the record supports they were deficient, can we just agree with that and move on to the prejudice, or do we need to make it also an individual finding of deficiency?
So you can assume, for the purposes of this appeal, that Corey Smith's trial counsel was deficient. I don't agree that the record supports it. But I mean, if the court does agree, this case was sitting in district court for 10 years before the court finally ruled on it. It's been almost 30 years since Corey Smith murdered Kimberly Brooks. And if there's nothing else, thank you.
Before you get up, Mr. Crystal, before I forget to do this, the Supreme Court issued a decision in a habeas case involving the prejudice prong of Strickland a couple of weeks ago. And so I've sent a note to Judge Luck and to Judge Abudu, and we're all in agreement. We're going to ask both of you to file simultaneous post-trial briefs, not to exceed 7 pages, addressing the impact, if any, of that case on our decision, given that it was decided after all of you filed your briefs. So if you don't have it, the citation is Thornell versus Jones, and the site is 144 Supreme Court 1302, decided on May 30th of 2024. So you have until July 15th, given the July 4th holiday that's coming up, you have until July 15th to file simultaneous 7-page letter briefs addressing the impact of that case. Okay? Mr. Crystal.
First of all, I thank the court for that opportunity. When you say file simultaneous briefs, are you expecting both sides to file on July 15th?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's not a response, reply sort
right.
of thing. Just
understood.
So my question to you is about this issue in terms of a finding of a mental disorder as opposed to reliance on the underlying facts. Can you explain to me, I mean, do we need, first, are you arguing simply on the disorder issue, or are you also pushing or exclusively pushing that the underlying facts of his family history were enough on their own to support a lesser sentence?
Well, we have two experts, a doctor, psychiatrist, and a psychologist, who give different opinions as to whether the underlying facts fit the definition in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for PTSD. Now, if you read the questioning at the post-conviction hearing, I believe it was the first one, it may have been the second one, where we discussed what exactly was required, the kerfuffle was over whether it had to be one event or could be a series of events, and it had to be what effect did it have on the person. Did this abuse, did it rise to the level of concern about serious bodily harm for himself or for his family members, his mother? So there's the diagnosis there. It's part of the record. My point, I guess, is the more important fact is the underlying facts of what happened. I'd like to first address Judge Luck. The juvenile record reference was solely to arrests. There was never any record anywhere because there was nothing. Let me back up. I assume the judge was referencing the pre-sentence report. If that assumption is correct, there is nothing but arrests in the pre-sentence report. If it's not, then the parties don't know what the judge was looking at. I think that suffices. Second point, in Pi, footnote 21, where the Pi en banc court was quoting the earlier case of Jefferson, I think the petitioner was trying to make the point that there was some per se rule. And Pi said, no, there's not a per se rule. But Pi did say, quoting Jefferson, brain damage profoundly changes the character of the penalty phase. It fundamentally transforms the defendant's sentencing profile. So that's a very significant statement, because even though that doesn't automatically mean the omission of that is prejudice, it is something that jurors and courts who are making this incredibly important decision, whether somebody lives or dies, would need to know.
The second part of that, or the first part of that statement from that same footnote, though, states, moreover, Jefferson is distinguishable because it applied a stricter pre-ADEPA standard of review to the state court's decision. This goes to Judge Jordan's question to you early on,
yes,
about us being in a bit of a different spot than some of these older cases.
No, I understand that, and I'm not suggesting that it automatically means prejudice, particularly in a deferential posture.
But the
point, I think.
But counsel, sorry to interrupt, but it doesn't. It's not just that it doesn't necessarily mean prejudice. The first sentence of that footnote says what you've just said.
Right.
But it's not just that. It's that these cases aren't really all that helpful to us because it's in a pre-ADEPA
right.
posture. That's separate, I think. Okay. Right.
That certainly is a separate point. That is a fair point, but I think the underlying statement about the effect of brain damage on a jury changing the sentencing profile of the defendant doesn't change, no matter whatever the standard is. It shouldn't change. I think Ferrell is an instructive case here. It's 640 Fed 3rd, 1199. It's this court's opinion. That was a double murder of a 72-year-old, Ferrell's 72-year-old grandmother and 15-year-old cousin. There were three aggravating factors: that it was committed during the course of a murder, so one murder was committed during the course of the other murder, it was committed during a course of a robbery, and it was outrageously and wantonly vile, horrible, or inhuman, involving torture and depravity of mind. In that case, the court found an unreasonable application of Strickland prejudice.
But wasn't, and sorry to interrupt, but Farrell, I've looked at all of these cases,
yep.
And I've tried to sort of try to understand where we
and
fit.
Both sides, I'm sure, thank you for that.
Well, but Farrell was an unrebutted evidence case. And I think we would be in a very different spot here if the evidence that you had submitted or that your client had submitted at the Rule 32 phase was unrebutted. But here, Dr. King and the rebutting of it seems to put us in a different spot, and that's why it seems that Pye is the closer analogy, I think, to maybe where Farrell is, no?
Well, I see your point. I hate when people say "with all due respect" and then significantly disagree, but with all
due
respect.
I do too, but feel free.
Right. I do disagree with the import of that statement. In Farrell, first of all, they said they find the unreasonable application whether they review it through the lens of AEDPA or not. And the court said, thus the mental health expert's opinion, and then I will answer your question directly, Judge Locke, thus the mental health expert's opinions would have served to reduce the volitional nature of the crime, as well as Farrell's ability to plan and act rationally, and as a result, undercut the senselessness and cold-blooded nature of the crime as stressed by the prosecutor. As far as the jury knew, and that's exactly the same here, Farrell did not suffer from brain damage. His emotional stability, impulse control, and judgment were perfectly normal. He could plan and understand the consequences of his actions as easily as the next person. The jury labored under a profoundly misleading picture of Farrell's moral culpability because the most important mitigating circumstances were completely withheld from it.
But isn't the problem, though, and thank you for pointing that out, that part, but isn't the problem here, though, that we don't take as a given all of those things?
No, and I
because,
want to...
So, but what is disputed is any extreme emotional distress, ability to understand right from wrong, all the underlying diagnoses, every one of them, including organic brain damage, significant intellectual disability other than reading, all of those things were disputed. So how can we say that, in other words, if I were to write that sentence again, the sentence would be a lot tamer. It would be the jury didn't hear that he was immature and that he had dyslexia and had trouble reading and that he had a drug problem, right?
No. Dr. King, and this is at document 131058 of this court's docket. I transferred all my sites to. He agreed that the brain impairment test showed moderate impairment, number one. Number two, he agreed that the category test, a separate test, this is on page 60 to 61 of document 1310, that it was most sensitive for frontal lobe issues, that these tests have cutoffs. So research gives a certain number of errors below which you're not brain impaired, above which you are brain impaired. So for the test that was most sensitive for frontal lobe damage, where executive functioning occurs, Dr. Golden had 88 errors, which Dr. King says was way above the cutoff. Dr. King had 108 errors, were way above.
Here's Dr. King's testimony. This is 15-46 at page 204. Question, based on your evaluation and testing you administered and the records you reviewed, do you agree or disagree in your expert opinion with the diagnosis of frontal or temporal lobe damage to his brain? Answer, I disagree with that. I found no evidence to indicate frontal or temporal lobe damage or any kind of brain damage.
Right. And it's easy on direct exam in kind of a summary fashion question to give that answer and on cross-examination to then be asked the questions that I asked about specifically about those tests and get the answers which were conflicting. So,
but the state court was able to hear all this and able to evaluate in a way that I can't just reading a cold transcript and made a call here that the experts that were presented by Mr. Smith were non-credible or their testimony should not be credited and Dr. King's testimony should be credited.
Yes, and I think the significant difference is when someone is asked about the significance of a test and what indicates brain impairment or not, and he says based on these tests he was way above the cutoff and impaired, and then gives a summary statement that he wasn't impaired, I think courts should go with, and I think it would be unreasonable not to at least look at and see what he was talking about the specific test on cross-examination. Judge Jordan, with respect to the deference issue and the whole panel, there's no way that you can read the sentencing hearing and the Rule 32 hearing and say that the evidence about the abuse and the drug use, according to the ACCA, which was based on the trial court statement, that the vast majority was cumulative. It's incredibly frustrating for a litigant, and I imagine you've been in this position. It just can't be read that way, because the things that were elicited post-conviction were never said. Not one word was said. So to say the vast majority was cumulative is just simply incorrect when you read the two transcripts. Having said that, the import is, under 2254D2, there was an unreasonable determination of the facts. I don't think there's any question about that. Now, there might be some more debate, as Judge Luck, as you're pointing out, as to whether the mental health experts or not was an unreasonable determination. But on the other line of evidence that we're talking about, it's just completely unreasonable to say the vast majority was cumulative and therefore there was nothing that was added post-conviction on that score. Having said that, there is no deference due to an unreasonably determined set of facts. Unless there are any questions, I'm giving back a minute and 15 seconds unless...
You don't need to. You've got the time allotted to you.
I think the focus really, or the analysis I would respectfully urge, is on the reliability portion of this. When you look at all the evidence that was presented post-conviction, and you look at what the trial court who was there in real time said about the cumulative mitigating evidence, he said, in his words, extremely weak. Now, if you're ranking presentations, extremely weak is one short step of it over and above having done nothing. So you can do nothing, or you can do something, and it's extremely weak. So in that context, can we say that executing this person who was 18 and 3 months, just under that at the time, that sentence is reliable and that confidence in the outcome is reliable? And I urge the court to find it was not. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Crystal, thank you very much. Mr. Malden, thank you very much as well. The argument was helpful. We're in recess for this case.
All right. Pre-argument.